When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Lance, your host of yesterday's concert. Before we get this episode started, I want to take 25 seconds to tell you about my other show, Jam Journals. Jam Journals is a podcast that takes you on a journey through music history, featuring live performances from some of the most iconic concerts of all time. Each episode recounts a different concert experience through a dramatic narrative that brings the memories to life with vivid detail and emotion. Join us as we take a trip down memory lane of some of the most unforgettable concerts in recent history. Jam Journals is available everywhere you get podcasts. Yesterday's Concert is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
I think that a lot of people probably get a sense of comfort from artists who provide that sort of escape. I think that that's why it's special to people and why it stands out and why we're seeing perhaps more of it comes to the forefront, because it feels authentic, it feels real. It's probably because it is. I think people like that.
Welcome to Yesterday's Concert, a podcast that celebrates live music. My name is Lance Ingram, and in this episode we talk to the Ruin Brothers. Henry and Rupert discuss how they use modern recording technology to create a classic sound on their new album, Ten Paces. Grab your earplugs for some technical recording talk. I'm here with the Ruin Brothers, Rupert and Henry Stansel. I'm really pumped to talk about your new album, but first I want to introduce each of you and kind of let you connect whose voice is whose.
Hey, this is Henry. Thank you for having us, Lance.
Yep. Hey, I'm Rupert, and I'm going to say I'm the younger brother. I think that's a good way to...
There we go.
Kick it off and introduce me.
Well, as is tradition on Yesterday's Concert, we like to start with a couple of icebreakers. So the first one, even though you guys were just telling me you moved to Louisville, we're still going to play this one because I think it's fun. We're going to do East Coast, West Coast. Which is the better one? All right. So I know, Henry, you were on the East Coast. Rupert, you were on the West Coast. You know, we're bringing back the old feud. Which one's the better coast?
Rue, what do you prefer? I think I know what you prefer.
I mean, I've got to say the West Coast for me personally, because I love going out for hikes and walks. And when we're making the record, and pretty much when we've made every record, I've done that daily. So, yeah, it's the West Coast for me.
I would say, although perhaps spent more time in New York and the East Coast living there, I think I prefer the West Coast. And it's only in terms of the fact that it's a bit of a slower pace out there. I mean, I'm being a little bit ignorant here saying that the East Coast is just New York City and the West Coast is just Los Angeles. In terms of the entirety of the East Coast, there's obviously fantastic cities and towns and locations, but in terms of places that we've experienced and we can talk on with more clarity, I would say Los Angeles. The weather, the pace, the natural beauty, I really love. West Coast wins.
There we go. That I like it. So like we were saying, you've moved to Louisville. Got a killer music scene in Louisville. What's something about the music scene that you've really didn't expect, but you've fallen in love with?
I'm going to give a little shout out to a relatively new venue that is right in the heart of our neighborhood that we moved to in the Highlands in Louisville. There's a sort of a creative members lounge called The Monarch, and the crew there, Mark, who helped build this place up to what it is, has welcomed us with open arms as now new locals. and introduced us to a wealth of just fantastic songwriters, performers, and it's been a refreshing like little gem. I don't think either of us experienced a community like that in London, in New York, in Los Angeles, and I think that's very special, and it's very special what he's doing, and it's building an audience that really has a passion for listening to intimate live music and appreciating songwriters and performers in that kind of environment. So that's been my favorite discovery, and I think it's super cool and it's very refreshing.
Yeah, there's a lot of talent here, which surpasses what I expected, you know, and it's really up my street in terms of the genre most people play here. So yeah, it's a great scene for us.
Okay, so next question. As I was telling you before, I'm in Memphis, and I know several of your influences have started their career in my city. So which would you rather record at in the height of their peaks, at the respective studio of Stax Recording Studio or Sun Studio? Which would you have rather spent time recording at?
That's a really good question. I am going to say Sun Studios, just because as teenagers, as young teenagers, we were gifted, I think, by our uncle Paul. He gifted us a Sun Studios CD, well, a CD live from Sun Studios. It had all these fantastic recordings on there. One in particular that really spoke to us was a Charlie Feathers number called Defrost Your Heart. And the fact that that came out of Sun Studios, I think it would be magic to be able to go to Sun Studios and even try and get close to something as cool as that with a recording. So if I could record anywhere, I think all those Stax, you know, that it's a tough question, but
yeah.
I'd probably go to Sun.
Yeah, I would say not for audio quality, but for vibe, I would say Sun Studios. I don't know, that's as you say, you know, we grew up listening to a lot of artists which recorded there, that, and I think at the fundamental level of what we do, we've been just heavily inspired by that studio's output.
I'm with you. I would have chose Sun. I mean, Stax put out so much great stuff, but it's just...
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of leads into the next picker, because, you know, as an Elvis fan, that just draws me in. But so the next question really is, what is the best era of Elvis's career in your opinions?
I mean, that's really tricky because, you know, he'd done great work all over the years, but I think that his early years, you know, that the 50s was such a good time, and there's so many songs from the 50s that I think we would cover in pubs and working men's clubs in the UK as teenagers. I remember All Shook Up would be a song that was like the opener to our set almost every time. People love to hear Elvis. I mean, Elvis, obviously, he's a worldwide phenomenon. But for me, I think it was the early years of Elvis. I think that's what resonates with me, and I find it exciting.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. The 50s was a pretty exciting time for him and for music in general when he came out. I mean, his recordings were quite basic in that early time, but they had a life to them, almost an underproduced vibe, which you know, really showed him off and his band, you know. Scotty Moore was a big influence on me, and you know, some of the stuff they did with delay back then, tape delay, created cool sounds, you know, like on Blue Moon and stuff. So that was an interesting period for music on the whole, but I think for Elvis's bringing Elvis to a center stage as like a pop star, I think that was an exciting time. I did also like his comeback special in the late 60s. That film concert or whatever, and where you can see them all do the little intimate part of the show where they just sit on chairs facing each other. I like that kind of vibe, that sort of the intimate recordings and performances of Elvis, even though he, you know, he was larger than life, those things weren't jazzed up in any way. You know, the later stuff, as much as I love, you know, guitar players like James Burton as well, which played with him later on, I think it's got to be the early stuff for me.
So my last one, why is Marty Robbins' Gunfighter Ballads and Trail Songs a 10 out of 10?
I think because he did it in 8 hours.
yeah, that's
that's impressive. He must have rehearsed those songs tremendously. I know his band was very talented. I think the bassist was an orchestrator or something. And yeah, it has a great sound, that record. There's a fantastic reverb on the whole thing, which I can only believe they just ran the whole recording, ran over the whole recording with by blasting it into a chamber or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. There's some magic to that. And it's nice to hear, you know, somebody sing some songs which are like trail songs with stories which have a little start, middle, and end as well. So lyrically, it's quite nice.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Roo. I think that for me, yeah, it's kind of the stories. It's, again, as well, the sound of the record and the instruments used. What we tried to do with our latest record, and it was a production choice, you know, predominantly made by Rupert, was much like there is almost a soundscape to this, to the Marty Robbins record. I feel like that is an element that you don't hear so much in modern day music and production, because I think people are trying to just deliver their song, and you know, there's fantastic production out there, and there's all different ways that you can approach a record and your singles and your music. But for us, like the Marty Robbins record did for us, it kind of put you in the space of Marty himself when he's singing those songs. You feel like you're there on that trail. And we wanted our record to create a visual image in their brain. So whether it's moving onto to our record here, like there's elements such as ricochets and claps of thunder and things like that. And although there's not really those like such significant elements within that Marty Robbins record, it's, you know, I got that feeling when I listened to that. And I think that's the feeling that we wanted to create with our new record.
It's like he's in the desert at midnight, and although he doesn't include like gunshots and thunderclaps like we do, what we have in extra little bits of production like that, he has in lyrics. So he'll talk about like his big iron and stuff, you know, in terms of a gun or whatever, and we'll make the sound instead. So,
well, that's kind of what I kind of touching on some of the stuff that I wanted to get into, because, you know, when I listen to your album, I think through like, it's not like you get labeled as like a Western noir act, and it's a little unfair because I think you're more than that. I think you're much more than that in a lot of ways, but you do evoke that classic Western spirit in your songs. And that's kind of the thing that I wanted to touch on, is like a lot of people look at just like a guitar twang to make a pop country song, but really like the thing that kept coming back to me was like the reverb in the songs. That's one of the things that really stood out to me, is like the reverb is creating a lot of that feel in your music. And I wondered if you could kind of talk about that.
Reverb is essentially, you know, you're emulating a space or spaces. Mm-hmm. And that can exist in terms of, you know, if you just place the microphones in a room and you're recording a band, you will, if you have the microphones far enough away from the instruments, pick up a certain room reverb. Well, what Marty Robbins recording has, and what, you know, some old scores to the Westerns had, was this added reverb afterwards, which was in the early days in chamber reverb form and a little bit later in plate reverb form. We used both of those types of reverb on our record to expand the space But not only that, to use those particular types of reverb to associate the space with those early recordings and early scores. So I think there's a dark quality to those reverbs, which sometimes may be out of place for modern recording artists if they want to make, say, pop music. But for the kind of thing we do, I think it helps transport the listener to different eras, which it's a little bit nostalgic. It adds that quality to the song. So, yeah, we love using reverb and experimenting with it. That being said, we basically only used a couple of different types and kept it simple, give the album a continuity as well.
To that, but to the point of the use of reverb to sort of create the space for the listener and what it does, as Rue said, certain reverbs and certain sounds will create this sort of more nostalgic feel and timeless quality, and much to the things that inspire us when we write our music and produce our music, often the source of inspiration for us, majority of our songwriting has come through film. I think for me, visually, film gives me like a launch pad for writing. When we write and when we record, we are inspired by things that typically have lasted the length of time. It's what's created an inspiration. It's what excites us most, these timeless qualities that you find in art, in cinema, in music over the decades. And I think that every choice that we make when it comes to the writing, the production, which, you know, encompasses the reverb on the record, every element that we has inspired us, every is considered when we're creating our own thing. So we want it to have those qualities and those feelings. So kudos to Rue for doing the technicalities on that.
It's not that difficult. It's very fun. Like just a couple points as well on the physicalities of the kind of reverb we use. Although we're using plugins to generally plugins to create these spaces, these vintage, you know, sounds, you know, it's all very, you know, plate reverb is actually a metal plate vibrating, and chamber reverb is, you know, pointing a speaker into a very reflective room and putting a microphone at the other end of it. So, you know, we like that sort of sound of, you know, it is emulating real space or real materials, and it's not like a digital. We try to lean away from the digital sounding effects, and I think that's what helps with that nostalgic quality too.
Well, I mean, that's kind of when I was listening to you guys and I started thinking about it, like there has been such, I feel like, and maybe I'm just imagining this, but it feels like there has been such a resurgence of timeless classic vintage music. I mean, you start thinking about like all the people out there, like Nathaniel Rateliff, Leon Bridges, Orville Peck, you know, Colter Wall, like Street. I mean, there's so many, you could list 1,000 names. Like, why do you think like that vintage nostalgic sound attracts people so much?
I think that it's a familiarity that it builds for a listener and somebody that in a day and age that we live in now, where we are fed just such a constant feed of, a lot of the time it's kind of throwaway content. Some of it is brilliant and some of it is not, and some of it is timeless and some of it is not. But there's such a flood of just so much stuff that I feel, and I can relate to it myself, because when I consume things, the things I'm drawn to tend to be this more nostalgic feeling. It reminds me of the things from my childhood, and the things from my childhood being, you know, what my parents would, you know, the music my parents would play us, the films that they would show us, the books that they would read us, the art that they would show us. I think that a lot of people probably get a sense of comfort from artists like the aforementioned, who provide that sort of escape. I think it is kind of an escape that those people are providing with their music and with the visual content that they create to accompany their music. I think that that's why it's special to people and why it stands out and why we're seeing perhaps more of it come to the forefront, because it does, it feels authentic, it feels real. It's probably because it is. I think people like that.
You said exactly what I was going to say, touched on comfort, because, you know, it's like you wouldn't want to sleep in a perfectly flat, hard bed. And I think that's what old sort of vintagey things tend to have, imperfections. And I think people are comfortable around imperfections to an extent. It makes things a little more tactile. And in the audio world, I think it crosses into that. I think also it's nice to see this resurgence at the same time, though I know that artists, you know, who were recording back in the 50s and 60s or even earlier, you know, they were always seeking perfection, and it was the technology of the day which kind of held them back. So what we tried to do is take these beautiful sounds and textures from recording of that period, but we do try to use modern technology to bring it out to the best of our ability, because it's brilliant now being able to do that new old sort of hybrid. And you know, there's no tape quality deterioration the more you play it back. You're not getting a loss of high end or anything. So yeah, we're able to preserve some extra detail with modern technology to really, I think people have the ability now to really show off them old sounds and that old equipment to its very best, if you know, recording engineers want to do that.
Well, that's one of the things when I was listening to the new album, 10 Paces, the song, The Fear, I don't know if it's a drum machine or what, if it's a live drummer or what, but it has that classic Sun Records, like clackety choo-choo rhythm to it. But it's done in such a modern way that it feels new, but it still has that familiarity that y'all were talking about earlier.
Oh, no, you're fully on point there. That's, I think it's a 1930s drum kit, but it's a VST, so it's a virtual instrument. We have some fantastic software, and basically somebody put in all the effort so we didn't have to make this software of recording these very old classic drum kits with old microphones and through old recording consoles. And then what we can do and what we did for The Fear was essentially write in the drum parts, and then we could play it back using these old sounds. So that is a 1930s drum kit, which you're hearing, but recorded in the present day and arranged by us. And then obviously using modern software, we affect it. And you can do everything with that software.
I think it adds another layer to creativity for us, because it allows us the freedom to, we've been in situations where we've a drummer playing the drum beat, and for some instances that's cool and it really works. But for us, we've found time and time again that through our creative process, having the freedom of having a kick drum from the 1930s at your fingertip, to be able to play with the sound of that and place it just where you want to place it. And it becomes almost I don't want to say an unhealthy obsession, but it does become an obsession where it's sort of like, well, we'll play with the rhythm to the song. We'll play with the drum beat. We'll play with all of these different elements until we find a pattern and a mold that just feels right. And that making this record, it was an amalgamation of those things. So it's interesting that you picked that out and you recognized it. And I'm kind of glad you did, because it allows us to now talk about this process, which I think is cool. And it's kind of something that in the world of score, a lot of indie score makers or upcoming score makers do. They've got the power of fantastic, you know, databases of instruments to play with and mold. And it allows you to just be so creative with the recording process. So it's something that we don't shy away from. And it's something that we kind of celebrate because it's kind of just, it's so fun.
But at the same time, we do limit ourselves. Like once we've the drum sound we like, we try to use it pretty much across the board, bar a little bit of tuning here and there on the skins. But yeah, we have to limit ourselves because we could go on forever, you know. So and it makes it sound, you know, consistent. And so once we find a sound, we commit to it. And I think the Fear was one of the first we recorded. So
when I was kind of reading the presser about this album and things, was there was a lot of mention to like the cinematics of it and things like that. And I know you guys have done, especially with the pandemic, you did a lot of sound design, you did a lot of scoring and things like that. So I was just curious how much of, because I mean, and it kind of goes back to the Marty Robbins comments as well, of like how much of that experience during that time really influenced what you did on this album. Because I mean, there's definitely a space to this album. There is definitely like you are in a environment as you listen to this. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Music for film, score, whether it's song for film or whether it's score for film, they're two slightly different beasts, and they require two slightly, well, in terms of film, they're both trying to achieve the same thing, which is a subtlety that just supports the picture. You're not trying to stand out too much. So the difference when it comes to making a record like this and incorporating elements of score, it was certainly something that over the pandemic, when we got to do that sort of stuff, it did sort of speak to Rue and I and very much so to Rupert, where it's like, hey, you know, this was a lot of fun getting to experiment with sound for score. And why don't we try and make this cool amalgamation of score and song when it comes to our own music? We feel that dynamically it's so cool because, as you say, it creates a space and there can be really gentle, subtle elements that, you know, you're not even really consciously recognizing, but they all add to just this space in your head. So yeah, it definitely was something that helped inspire us with this record. I'm thankful for at least that element of the pandemic and getting to play around and have the opportunity to do that sort of stuff. It certainly did influence this.
I would say as well, when you are just a duo, you don't have to use, say, a drummer or a bassist or a keys player. You don't have to include them if they're not part of the band. So, you know, your options are limitless. So we tried to approach it with that kind of ethos of sort of anything's possible. And I think also a few artists of the past, more in sort of like the swing genre, like Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, all those kind of people, their songs were much more orchestrated, even though they were, for their day, like the popular music. You know, everything was written out, everybody had different parts, and you know, they did often try put the audience in the space with them. I know that is the case with the musical Calamity Jane, which I think came out in 1953, where if you listen to the arrangement around the songs, they do incorporate these Western sort of motifs and elements to build a soundscape. So we're not the first to do it, but we certainly
celebrate
doing it, and we haven't heard it in a while. So
no, that's really good, and that's, I mean, you'll have to forgive my ignorance on this one, but you know, how much of this creating the space and creating an atmosphere of the songs is done in the songwriting process versus done in the recording process? I mean, how much of it is studio versus pen to paper?
I think, well, all of it starts pen to paper. There's no doubt about that. It always, with us, will be an idea, and it'll start with typically like a melody hook, something that you can't get out of your head, and maybe like just a phrase. And we build out from that. It's like a lot of little ripples. It's like, oh, I thought of this great phrase, or this phrase came to mind, or whatever. Oh, and immediately your head goes to a melody for it. And then you've got that melody and you're like, okay, cool phrase, cool melody. That's cool. Okay, what else do I need to build this? And then it's like, I think it's like somebody making a sculpture with like a little chisel and a little hammer. And I think that's the way that we go about building, with like a little invisible chisel and hammer between ourselves. And often, you know, often it's a case where, you know, we'll do these ideas will come separately. It's not often that we are physically both together and we've both been inspired by something. We both sit down to like write something together. And so to that, it feels, you know, it feels like a very organic process from the start, which is really nice. Rupert will come to me, I'll come to him, and then the production will follow that. And typically the production will be sparked by Rupert, production element ideas. It's something Rupert's passionate about and really understands very well. Technically, he's much more sound than me in that respect. I know what I like, and I know what I like to hear and what I think sounds good. But the proficiency that Rupert has when it comes to engineering and producing, that really helps take the early form of the creation, the songwriting, which is crucial. It's something we learned in our process on our first record with Rick Rubin, when we came to, before we started recording, before we started putting down any of the songs, as Rick said to us, he said, you know, the most important thing is the songwriting. Comes before anything else. If the song is not a good song, you can dress it up all you want, but it will never be a good song. So you have to get the songwriting right first. And that's something that has stuck with us ever since that process. And it's something that we always focus on first. So it's always songwriting followed by production.
We did have some intentional choices, which we made to get across a bit of a Western and Americana sort of genre and association within the fundamentals. So for instance, on Hi-O, our song Hi-O, in the chorus, the chords there, we were thinking, you know, when we were writing it, like what sort of chords did they use for these Western scores? Although they often didn't have lyrics in them, the arrangement did make, you know, chords. And that is an example of one of the songs where at its fundamentals, it does have Western chord movements in it. You know, we kind of had the concept of the Western sort of album early on. So we did sort of move certain elements around to emphasize that, because we just loved the genre and it appealed to us very much. So in the writing, as Henry says, in the fundamentals, there are choices made to get it on the right path, to give it sort of a Western sound. And I mean, you can do it in production to an extent, but, you know, it's like writing any song and putting jingle bells in the background and calling it a Christmas song. It can't always work. So I do think at the fundamental level, choices there do have a big impact on the final outcome.
Yeah. We were kind of obsessed with that. We watched time and time again the movie The Night of the Hunter. We were watching that over COVID. And I think you go through these like moments where you get inspired by something, and that's what helps inspire what you make. And I think that's kind of how we've always worked.
Henry, I want to go back to something you directly said, and Rupert, you alluded to it. I've been fascinated lately with melody, just the concept of it and hearing it and kind of learning more about it. And you know, when I've read about interviews with you guys, you're pretty open admitting that you love melody and you're both good at it. And I will firmly agree that you both are very talented melody creators. So it's a two-part question. So it's, where do you think you developed the skill for melody, and what inspires melody in your life when you're writing songs now?
Awesome. Yeah. That's interesting. It's not been, no one's ever really posed that to me. So I think that from our childhood, it stemmed very early from that, because a lot of the music that our dad would play for us growing up, although he would play like albums, he would often be playing songs in the house that were these hit songs from all of these different artists. Like, there was a lot of compilation albums, like greatest hits albums, that we would be listening to growing up. Yes, there was, you know, classic albums that we listened to, but there was a lot of greatest hits stuff. And a common pattern amongst all of those songs was there's typically a great lyric in there. The melody is infectious in a way where you hear it once or twice and then it's in your head. And so many times as a kid, I would get obsessed with a chorus or just a line or a lyric. And it was often due to the melody and the combination of the words, the vowel sounds, the placement of the words within the melody line. And I think that is something that is really cool to me, and something that really, you know, I like to focus on when I'm writing, because if it was cool to me as a kid, I hope it would be cool to somebody else, you know, if I can find that same quality. And so in our teenage years, we would be playing these songs by Elvis, by Roy Orbison, by Chuck Berry. And a lot of these songs, the melodies were just so good. And we were singing these melodies week in, week out to earn money to help our parents pay rent and to like get by. And so week in, week out, just for many of our formative years, we were always singing these songs with just great melody lines. So naturally, when it came to writing songs for us and writing melody lines, it was something that just we naturally felt had to have like an importance. It had to be like a key focus point within our songs. And something with Rupert's sort of like, with Rupert's classical background, playing classical guitar growing up, Rupert knew how to achieve those melody lines in a way that made them hooky, because he understood how to write them. He would, you know, between us, we would break them down, and that's how we would build them ourselves. So that's kind of, it's always just been a thing that we liked. And so I think it's a thing that we always focus on when we're writing. I think it's probably the predominant thing in our writing, the melody line.
I think a lot of songwriters owe it to what they listened to growing up. There's certainly a psychology behind, you know, writing a melody and why it appeals to people. Nobody can sort of quite put the finger on it. And, you know, it tries, you know, people try to quantize it in terms of like, you know, it has to have repetition or take it up an octave or whatever, you know, so you can give it these rules, but I can only theorize that these rules like repetition are, again, to develop familiarity. So whatever you listen to as a child, there's a familiarity towards those kind of melodies, which we lean into when we're writing. And I would say that because, as Henry says, you know, listening to greatest hits albums, that's got a wide appeal. So it's very kind of you to say that, you know, we're great melody writers, but I don't know, maybe it's just the case that we write our melodies like, you know, the songs we grew up listening to, which had a wide appeal.
You're saying that, but like Bullet Blues, like I've only heard it a handful of times and it's already stuck in my head. The earworm is there. I mean, it's firmly been planted. So, I mean, you can downplay it some all you want, but like it really, you guys do have the touch. I mean, it is very apparent in your music.
Thank you.
One thing, I may take us completely off course going here, but I'm curious because I've heard it from other artists and I experienced myself. So you guys grew up on vintage music. I'm assuming we're around the same age. I'm 34. How old are y'all? You may be younger than me.
33. Andrew's okay. 30. Yeah, so we're
okay.
All
so we're right there. So I mean, like, I grew up on Elvis. Like, and it's not an exaggeration. There was literally 5 years of my life where that was the only thing I listened to before middle school, and then I transitioned from Elvis to classic rock. And it kind of seems like you guys kind of have a similar lineage in terms of artist and eras. what was it like growing up being fans of that music? Because it's not popular. I mean, for our age, like, it's not popular. It's not cool at all.
Yeah.
By most standards. What was it like for you guys growing up?
Yeah, I totally, I sympathize with what you're saying, because I think I used to feel, and I'm sure Rupert used to feel, like, amongst our peers at school at like 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, you know, those formative years, those years where kids are cruel. and you, if you're not like you, 5 years of Elvis, we the same sort of deal. And while everybody else was listening to, and don't get me wrong, I enjoy songs from all these artists, but when other kids were like listening to Blink 182 and Sum 41, and who I love, but while those were sort of like popular artists, the Spice Girls, you know, Dre, Eminem, all of these like pop culture phenomenons, Britney Spears, all of these things, although we were aware and you'd listen to it, and then it wasn't something that was the like the key element that you were raised on. It wasn't it. And I remember it being, I would have a bit, I would feel a little embarrassed about loving that music, or like trying to tell my friends about it or play that music or be playing those kind of songs. It felt like it wasn't cool. It felt like, or at least amongst my peers, it wasn't cool. But then we were at such a young age, like 11, 12, 13, 14, playing in these like very hard environments. We were going into like very grown up adult working men's pubs and clubs in our hometown.
Before the smoking ban.
And like in these smoky, just, you know, where like very adult things were going on. And we were experiencing that. And we would play the music that we loved, that we were raised on. And those people loved that. Everyone loved it.
Yeah.
But they were an older audience. So we always connected with this older audience. Even as teenagers, as kids, we had, we related to them.
They were slightly confused, though, I remember. They would often ask us, like, well, how do you know this song? And why are you playing this kind of music? I mean, it's great, but yeah, how come? And so, you know, get asked this question a lot. But, you know, we have to give a little bit of credit as well to some of the local bands which played in our hometown. Granted, they were a lot older than us. There was one band called The Bad Lads, and they had been around since the 60s. And they were then in their 60s, 70s. They'd invite us to their rehearsals. We live close to the lead singer of that band. And so we'd sit in and we'd always, you know, be amazed at how much it sounded like a CD, we used to say, compared to the bands at school who were, you know, the kids who were making bands there. So we would naturally try and be like these older people who to us sounded a lot better. And, you know, the north of the UK where we're from, I think one of the reasons they love that old American music is, I do know the lead singer of that band, The Bad Lads. He told me a story where, you know, an American record, whether it be by Elvis or somebody, would come out, be released, and they would drive to Liverpool, which is about, you know, 4 hours from where we grew up. They would drive to Liverpool just to get that record because that's where the American records were shipped into. So there is a big love for that kind of music amongst the older people in the north of the UK. And as Henry says, the people we were hanging around with and playing music in front of. So, but it was definitely weird around people our age.
And I think you're in America listening to that. We're in the UK listening to that. I know like sometimes even folks that we come across in America will be kind of confused as to why, like, oh, you guys are from the UK, but you like this sort of like country music and this you like this Americana genre and you like all these artists. And it's like, well, while that is unusual because we're an ocean apart, it's not that unusual because our parents grew up on it. Our hometown was hooked on it and we were raised on it. And so it's kind of cool to us that we've managed with our music to carve out this life where we get to make music that we love, that celebrates, you know, everything that we were influenced by growing up. So it just feels like a very, although a weird journey and a weird sort of childhood and teenage years listening to and being influenced, it's kind of come full circle for us now, and it just feels like that's how it should be.
No, that's actually, I feel like that's because it's come full circle. I mean, that again, my mind was going back to Marty Robbins, and just the familiarity aspect of it, I think, is part of why younger kids are going to it now. I mean, it's so weird to see, like, I follow all these different record pressing plants and things like that and labels. And like, I feel like that album's always getting repressed. It's always getting some new like color variation or something. And I'm like, who's buying this record? And, I mean, it's a lot of kids, apparently, like younger generations are buying that album because there's things on that there's, like you were saying earlier, like they're searching for the real, they're searching for that. But it's also just a lot of themes that are universal across generations that people can connect with.
Yeah.
So I feel like we've come full circle in this conversation, and this is a great place to wrap it up, guys. This was really fun. Rupert, I really enjoyed all of your technical talk. I don't know much about recording, but I could listen to that kind of stuff all day, man. It was killer. Henry, it was a pleasure, man. I love that you could feel my pain talking about growing up an Elvis fan. So this was really great, guys. I'm really grateful that I got to speak with you guys. 10 Paces, by the time this is released, the album will be out for everyone to hear. Fantastic album. I thoroughly enjoy it. I think it's a great evolution of your sound. I think it's another great album in your lineage. So good job, guys. I can't wait for the world to hear it.
Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, and just to echo what you said, we really appreciate you having us on, and thank you for, you know, asking us such thoughtful questions. It, you know, I this is what doing this is about, and I love it. And so thank you.
Yeah, it's great to be able to tell people about it, because like more people about it, because at the moment I'm just boring my wife and Henry
with the, I'm glad you got to burn my ears up tonight talking about it instead of belaboring your poor wife any longer. I'm glad we got to do this tonight, guys. Thanks so much, guys.
Awesome.
Cheers. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye. I'm Lance Ingram, and this is Yesterday's Concert. Thanks for listening to another episode of my show. For more live music podcasting, check out our other show, Jam Journals. If you're feeling kind, give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and check us out on all the social media platforms. Email us at info@yesterdaysconcert.com or visit our website, yesterdaysconcert.com. So until next time, give us a subscribe, tell your friends, and most importantly, take care of your shoes.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.